This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Beloved brands know customer relationships are everything. That's why over 130,000 trust Klaviyo to power smarter digital relationships across their websites, emails, SMS, and reviews. And now, there's Klaviyo AI, your guide to smarter insights, decisions, work, and results. Brands like Everyman Jack trust Klaviyo AI to personalize product recommendations that keep customers coming back. Discover Klaviyo AI at klaviyo.com/Vox. That's klaviyo.com/Vox.
From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Stay Tuned. I'm Preet Bharara.
The reason why I think CAS is such a useful term in understanding human interactions and the impulse to categorize and then rank is that it has the potential to take certainly Americans away from the emotions that get attached to race and racism.
That's Isabel Wilkerson. In 1994, as the Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times, she became the first African-American woman to win a Pulitzer Prize in journalism. Wilkerson joined me in August of 2020 to discuss her latest book, Caste: The Origins of Our Discontents. It became a New York Times bestseller and was nominated for the National Book Award. This week, we are re-airing in full the conversation I had with Wilkerson about caste, which examines how hierarchies form across societies, from the United States to India to Nazi Germany. Nearly 2 years after my conversation with Wilkerson, I am still thinking about her book and its lessons. That conversation is coming up. Stay tuned. Support for Stay Tuned comes from Mint Mobile. The secret to Mint Mobile's premium but affordable wireless plans is that they sell them totally online. Mint Mobile was one of the first to cut out the costs of retail, and they then passed those savings on to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly plan or unexpected fees. You can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. That includes unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy and painless, and you don't even need a new device when you do. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/preet. That's mintmobile.com/preet. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/preet. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. Growth can be wonderful, but it comes with complications. Like finding that new pair of shoes for your kids when they get too big, or upgrading that puppy food to an adult recipe. And when you're a business owner, it's the same thing. You understand that as your company grows, the cracks can start to emerge, and your tasks can get more complicated. That's why you should know these three numbers: 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000. That's the number of businesses which have been upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. 1. Because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. Manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow, all in one place. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/preet. That's netsuite.com/preet to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/preet. This week, we are revisiting a discussion I had with author Isabel Wilkerson about her best-selling book, Caste: The Origins of Our Discontents.
Her work remains urgent today.
Isabel Wilkerson, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the book. It's called Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. And let me just, can I add my small voice to all the waves of praise that you've gotten for the book? I read every page from beginning to end over the weekend, and it had a lot of praise that preceded it, but I found it to be an enormously important work. Can't put it down. For me, it was a combination of not just the ideas that you have in the book and the analysis in the book, but also how you string it all together with stories and metaphors. And so I also could not put it down. So it's a magnificent achievement, and I congratulate you. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about some of the things you say in the book. This took you a number of years, am I right?
It did. It actually began with my first book, The Warmth of Other Suns, which was about the great migration of African Americans who were fleeing the Jim Crow South. And in order to write that book, I had to do a tremendous amount of research into what life was like for people during the 100 years or so of formal segregation system in the Jim Crow South, and made these discoveries of what it was actually like, that it was so control that it was actually against the law for a Black person and a white person to merely play checkers together. There were separate Bibles, one for Black people, one for white people, when they were swearing to tell the truth on in court. There were restrictions at every turn based upon what you looked like. In other words, the group to which you were attached or categorized. And I emerged from that research, and also from having interviewed 1,200 people and then doing a tremendous amount of reading as to what anthropologists and sociologists had described that world as. And that's where I came across the term caste to describe the Jim Crow South as it existed, as many, even Americans, are not really fully often educated because it's not emphasized or even really taught. The Great Migration is not taught in schools, or has not until this book came out. So most people really didn't have a sense of what it was like to live in that world. And the people who did the research into that world, the anthropologists and sociologists who immersed themselves in that world doing ethnographies in the 1930s and 40s, emerged with that word as the only word they felt was accurate to describe the hierarchy that they observed and that they actually lived for a time. And that is how I came to the word. And so the word racism does not appear in The Warmth of Other Suns, although many people might attach that word to the book, but that word does not appear in the book. The word that I came to use that I thought was more sufficient and comprehensive in capturing what the people were enduring was caste.
So before we get to what you mean by caste, and you're right, it's not something that people have a deep understanding of in the United States. Caste and race, as we'll get to in a moment, they overlap, they intersect with each other in various ways. But first, I thought I would ask you about what your thoughts are on what race and racism are. And here are a couple of things you say in the book. Quote, race as we have come to know it is not real. It is a fiction told by modern humans for so long that it has come to be seen as sacred truth, end quote. And then you also say, color is a fact, race is a social construct, end quote. Explain what you mean by those things.
Well, race as we now know it is a fairly new term in the arc of human history. It's only 400 or 500 years old in terms of what we now view as the delineation of human beings on the basis of skin color and other physiological characteristics. This does not mean that the skin color is new to humanity or that the physical characteristics that might distinguish one group of people have not always been there. People have always looked the various ways that they do. But the way that they look did not delineate either by law or custom or culture in the ways that it ultimately would in the early years and decades of colonial America. In this country, the idea of race is relatively new. The idea of race in humans identifying themselves on the basis of what they look like solely is relatively new. Before then, people were Irish, or they were Polish, or they were Hungarian, or they were Ndebele, or they were Yoruba, whatever they might have been. They didn't need to identify themselves by color because they were all fairly contained on land where everyone pretty much looked the same. So that would not have been the signifying, determining factor of how you identify a person. But when people from all over the world, peoples from all over the world converged in the New World, then the metrics of hierarchy began to be established and then calcified. And one of the things that I say about caste in general as a phenomenon, as an idea, is that caste is essentially an artificial hierarchy of graded ranking of human value in a society that determines standing and stature and respect, benefit of the doubt, access to resources through no fault or action of one's own. I mean, you are born to that role and that placement in the caste system. And each hierarchy, each caste system uses a different metric that works for their culture, their society, and that, you know, going back to however they were first identified, whether by use of religion, by use of ethnicity, by use of geographic origin. And in the case of the United States, skin color became the signifier of where one fell or where one was assigned in the artificial hierarchy that was created here. In other words, where a person was situated in the hierarchy within the caste system was determined by what they looked like. Race became the tool for delineating people. Race became the signal of a category that you were assigned to. Race is the cue, was the cue and remains in shadow as we have inherited all of this, is the cue of where one is positioned in the hierarchy. So that is the difference between them. I say that, you know, race, the caste is the bones, race is the skin. And race is what we can see, but it's the signal of as to where one belongs in the caste system or where one is perceived as belonging in the caste system.
Yet you quote from James Baldwin in your book, who said, no one was white before they came to America, because that's not how people thought about themselves. And then you also say later in the book, you know, there are no black people in Africa. They're just themselves. They didn't become black until they came to America. What was different about America that caused these delineations to be made? Because people have been around for a long time.
Yes. And the idea of slavery is obviously a part of American history. But of course, it is obviously a part of world history. And, you know, humans have enslaved others for, you know, for millennia. So slavery as an idea is not new. What made it distinctive in the United States was the idea of chattel slavery, the idea that you were born into essentially an enslaved caste of people who could not escape by any means, as it was conceived by law, that you inherited the standing, meaning the low standing of one's mother. It was passed through the mother, and it was generational, and with no means of escape, unless you literally kind of kidnapped yourself and then escaped, meaning you were viewed as having taken the property of someone else because you didn't even belong to yourself. That was one way. And of course, there was an entire network of enforcement to keep people from doing that, and unimaginable punishment for people who managed to escape that way. So very, very few people did when you consider how many people were enslaved. And then, of course, one could, you know, work really hard, and there could be exceptions where you could have been, where some slave owner might have had a change of heart and freed their enslaved people. But the escape routes were narrow, very narrow. And so this was the origin. These were the origins of the hierarchies that we live with today. The subtitle of the book is meaningful, and that is, it's the origins of our discontents. It's an attempt to look back to find out, where did this begin? How did we get to this point? Where did the gradations and artificial hierarchies, where did this emerge? And so when people were brought here, you know, kidnapped and brought across the Atlantic during the transatlantic slave trade, they entered into what became a bipolar caste system, unlike the one in India that has the four main varnas and then the outcast of Dalits. This was a bipolar caste system in which there was the dominant group, which would be the British colonists themselves, and then the ones at the bottom, meaning the people of African descent who were brought in to be enslaved. Literally by arriving, they were assigned clearly to the very bottom of what was an emerging bipolar caste system. I should also, of course, say that the Indian caste system, the original, there are some similarities, of course, many, 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 many differences. That caste system, the original caste system, the most recognizable in the world, is very, very complex with thousands of jatis or subcastes beneath the main varna. So I recognize that. I'm merely saying that the American one was a bipolar system with the two poles of the, you know, the dominant caste and then the subordinated caste. And that anyone entering that caste system, getting to your question, and sorry for the long-winded way of getting to it, but anyone entering that system who did not automatically fit either as British or as African, of African descent, had to navigate this bipolar world, which then created what I call middle castes of people who sometimes move about in between. And there are many different names for people in that group. People might say people of color, they might say marginalized people. In earlier, you know, decades and centuries of American history, the groups that I mentioned that were not British but were European also had to find ways to fit into that bipolar system. And upon arrival, as we just discussed, when they arrived, they were not necessarily thinking about, nor had they ever had to think about themselves as white. That was not a term that you would use in describing yourself if you were Polish or if you were Hungarian in, you know, 1892. I mean, you just would not, that's not the language that would have been necessary or how people would have needed to see themselves. But upon arrival, they then ended up being assigned to that category.
What's also different between the Indian caste system and what you talk about with respect to America is that that vocabulary is very familiar in India. I'm Indian. I was born in India. And someone writes a book about caste, and I've read some of the works of Dr. Ambedkar and others that you refer to in the book. No one blinks an eye. There's a huge amount of scholarship about the caste system in India. You write a book called Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents, that goes to some of the issues that other people frame as a matter of race and racism. And some people raise their eyebrows, which I think is kind of interesting. The other thing that resonated with me, and you may not appreciate this, is the extent to which when you have a caste system like you have in India, how much that goes with you even when you leave India. So I left the country when I was a year old, came to the United States with my father and mother who wanted to come to the US for a better life. And I was thinking back when I was reading one of your chapters that I was told, here we were growing up living in New Jersey, and I was told, I don't know, just as a matter of sort of history or background or, I don't know, some kind of pride by my father, what our caste was. Do you want to take a guess?
I have not been able to see you in interacting with other people, which is one of the things that I say in the book was helpful to me in being able to ascertain it. But statistically speaking, most of the people who had the wherewithal to get this far from the originating country of India would have been upper caste people, one of the upper castes.
So yes, I was told that we and our family were Kshatriyas, right? The warriors. And, you know, said with some pride, again, it was to us, my brother and I, to my brother and me, it was just sort of trivia and kind of interesting in the same way they would tell us other stories about the motherland. But what's also interesting to me is you have a scene in the book where you're talking to a scholar, I think at a conference from India, who describes himself as being part of the Kshatriya caste, the warrior caste. And you think to yourself, this is a kind of a small guy. You know, think of this guy as being a warrior.
Yeah.
The same could be said of members of my family. So it's an oddity and a weirdness over time that I think still kind of confuses people. The other thing you say about caste is race is the front man for caste. What does that mean?
It means that it is the most visible thing that we see. It does the heavy lifting for what is ultimately a hierarchy that is not visible to people because people get focused on what they can see. And as we were saying about how color is a fact, but race is a social construct, none of this is actually real. It's not real. None of this is real. This is an effort to try to see beneath what we think we know. And, you know, we get so sidetracked by what we see and race becomes the most visible manifestation of what's underneath it, which is the hierarchy that is the foundation. And the reason why I think caste is such a useful term in understanding human interactions and the impulse to categorize and then rank is that has the potential to take certainly Americans away from the emotions that get attached to race and racism and other language that we use now, white supremacy, whatever the words might be. The words that the longer we use them, then in some ways, the less we're able to hear them. And I think that caste does not have that freight for the American ear. It allows us to, in my view, it allows us to focus on the structure of a thing. You know, caste, I just became really quite fascinated with the way that in English, and also obviously coming from the Romance languages of caste and casta, the Portuguese term that was ultimately used late in the game, of course, in defining what was a caste system in India, the word is a Portuguese word. But the idea of what caste actually means, I mean, caste has multiple meanings in English. One of them is the mechanism that's used to hold fractured bones in place. You put a cast around the bones in order to keep them in a fixed place. You think about cast in a play where you have people, you know, characters who are all supposed to, you know, follow a certain script, and everyone knows their lines, and they may even know the lines of other people, and everyone knows where they're supposed to be when the play is ongoing. And we just absorb those things, but all of them having to do with placement, where you fit, who belongs where, who is stepping out of his or her place. And everyone knows it's embedded in the thinking of it, but we don't often see it. And so that's the reason why I see caste as the underlying infrastructure that delineates and categorizes people by many, many different metrics. I mean, even in any caste system, I mean, I would add, I mean, this is my, you know, spending all this time looking at it primarily from the American perspective, but reading as much as I could, was the idea that any kind of human ranking could take any possible characteristic and use that to create a hierarchy. I mean, I have a reference to people being tall or short. I mean, it could have just as well been that in the United States as it was forming, or in the Western world as it was created. It was colonizing the West.
Yeah, you talk about this great, you talk about this experiment done by a school teacher where for part of the day, she said the people with blue eyes are dominant, and then the rest of the day, the people with brown eyes are dominant. And that was a very compelling portion of the book. Within 15 minutes, the superior-eyed people, so to speak, began to engage in behaviors that they had not engaged in before and began to act in a demeaning way towards the others in an entitled way, just on the basis of an arbitrary decision by a teacher to differentiate them in a hierarchy based on eye color.
Based on something that they couldn't control, and as you say, was completely arbitrary. The stunning thing about that case, and dispiriting on some level, is that they were such young children, for one, and that the way that she set it up by saying, the brown-eyed children are not as smart. The brown-eyed children do not work hard. The brown-eyed children are slow. And therefore, the brown-eyed children will not be able to stay out on the playground for as long as the blue-eyed children. They will not be able to get second helpings at lunchtime. But the blue-eyed children, who are smarter and more responsible, they will get to stay out on the playground longer, and they will get to have all of these additional things that they can do. And one of the things that happened is that as the experiment was beginning, she told the children to then turn to a particular page in the book, in their textbook. And one little girl was taking a little longer to find the page. And the teacher purposely, as part of her experiment, said, you know, why haven't you found it yet? Why are you still looking for it? You're holding up the class. And then one of the other little boys, who was a blue-eyed boy, immediately said, well, she's a brown-eyed.
he instantly.
How quickly that can happen, right?
Exactly.
It is dispiriting. Very dispiriting. So, but you say something else, going back to what you were discussing a moment ago about words and their meaning and whether people listen properly or not. And when people start talking about race and racism, there are some folks that maybe don't listen in the way that they might otherwise. And one of the reasons that maybe you talk about caste is based on the sentence that you have in the book where you say, caste is insidious and therefore powerful because it is not hatred. It is not necessarily personal. So by framing these issues as a matter of sort of caste hierarchy, as opposed to racism, which implies hatred and implies something quite personal, whether it's directed towards a group or an individual person, is the value of that that it enhances the dialogue? And is there a potential criticism that it lets some people off the hook whose behavior is not really sort of this subconscious understanding of caste, but really is intentional hatred and racism?
Oh, no, they actually, no, thank you. That's such a great distinction you're making. No, this is not to say at all that racism does not exist. I mean, I acknowledge and say that it's a tool. It serves a purpose in animating and triggering and being the sort of the loudest voice in the room when it comes to something like this. You know, caste, as I said, is sort of the worn grooves of routines and assumptions and what we accept as the sort of the laws of nature. This is where these people are, and this is where these people are. And when we are planning to meet, we're told that we're about to meet a person who is the CEO of this company, or we're going to meet someone who is, you know, a homeless person. There are certain things that come to mind in our society that everyone has been exposed to what these things, who is presumed to be where in our society. We make assumptions on the basis of gender. We make assumptions on the basis of ethnicity, on the basis of race and national origin.
But are those things sexism and racism? Let me quote back to you from something in the book. And by the way, the reason I'm quoting from you so much is there's so much memorable in here. I don't usually do this. And if we were doing this live and in person, you would see how many post-its I have. Very colorful post-its on the book. And you say this, and I think this is interesting. I wonder what people's reactions will be. You say, quote, in everyday terms, it is not racism that prompts a white shopper in a clothing store to go up to a random black or brown person who is also shopping and to ask for a sweater in a different size, or for a white guest at a party to ask a black or brown person who is also a guest to fetch them a drink, as happened to Barack Obama as a state senator. And then you tell many, many stories, including about yourself, where when you were a New York Times reporter and the person you were going to interview who was white just wouldn't believe that you could possibly be a New York Times reporter. And you say that's not racism. Other people would say it is. Can you elaborate?
Let me say that that racism and what you might say casteism or caste at work can interconnect, overlap, and be occurring at the same time. It's not to say that they're not. Caste is the underlying basis of all of these other isms. And so a person might not openly see themselves as racist. There are many, many people, probably the majority of people do not see themselves as racist. And if they don't, then I would say we have to go along with it. I mean, how do you suss out a person who's racist? I mean, is there a trial that one has just to nail someone to the wall, pin them to the wall and say, yes, you are? I mean, what have we achieved if we focus in on that and that alone as the deciding factor of who is a good person or a bad person, which is often how it gets conflated. That does not mean that they are not happening at the same time. What I would say is that if one is racist, then they are automatically casteist. Casteist goes underneath it. I mean, casteist is the infrastructure. It's the foundation for all other isms that affect where a person is positioned or assigned or placed in a hierarchy. But you could conceivably be casteist, meaning you are invested in maintaining the hierarchy as it is without even being aware of it. And your actions might reflect that. But you feel no personal animus toward people who look a certain way. And you would say, I do not hate the people. If a person says they don't hate, what do you do with that? I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to take emotions out of it. Because a person can easily deny the emotion. They can easily look past. They can say, no, no, no. They could be waving a Confederate flag and still say, I'm the least racist person you'd ever meet. I mean, this is part of our everyday parlance. I mean, you hear that. You hear something along those lines all the time. And so I feel as if it's been so derailed that maybe it's time for new language. Maybe it's time for us to see ourselves differently, you know, to allow us to look through a different lens that is not freighted, at least in the American sense of the word, with the same emotions of shame and guilt and blame and deflecting and derailing, all the things that happen when these words get used. It allows us to see ourselves differently using language that has been used in the past to describe American hierarchy. I am not the first person by any means to put this word out there in reference to the United States. It's been used for a century and a half, going back to the time of the Civil War for certain. So this is just a way to allow us to perhaps explore how else we might see ourselves, given that this word has been used in the past and many aspects of it do apply to us now. And that's the reason for all that. I view it as kind of like an X-ray of the country.
So, Isabel, I'm going to quote from your book again, because what you just said strikes me in some ways as going to the heart of the matter. How do you explain to people who don't think that they're terrible, who don't think that they're racist, who don't think that they're bad, how do you explain to them what the problem is and that they have to be engaged in the solution also? And you use a lot of great metaphors in the book, one of which is the metaphor of a house. You say, with an old house, the work is never done and you don't expect it to be. And you say, America is an old house. And then I think even more compellingly, to carry on the metaphor, you say, quote, many people might rightly say, I had nothing to do with how all this started. I have nothing to do with the sins of the past. My ancestors never attacked indigenous people, never owned slaves. And yes, not one of us was here when this house was built. Our immediate ancestors may have had nothing to do with it, but here we are, the current occupants of a property with stress cracks and bowed walls and fissures built into the foundation. We are the heirs to whatever is right or wrong with it. We did not erect the uneven pillars or joists, but they are ours to deal with now. And any further deterioration is, in fact, on our hands. End quote. That seems to me to go right to the heart of the problems we have in the country. and is very understandable. Why is it so hard for people to get that point?
This is not a pleasant thing to think about. If you're in a house, an old house, you don't want to think about the things that are wrong with the house. I mean, after rain, you don't want to go into the basement after a rain and confront whatever may be in there if there's a leak in the basement. You would rather not have to think about it. If you can manage to, you know, to move about in your life and in your world without thinking about it, of course, it's human to not want to think about those things. But as I say, you know, if you don't go into the basement after rain, it's at your own peril. You will have to deal with the consequences of whatever's going on in the basement, whether you choose to look at it or not. Not looking at it doesn't make it go away. And you will have to deal with the consequences at one, you know, eventually one way or the other, you'll have to. And that's why I make use of the metaphor. It came to me that that was one way to remind ourselves that we are, in fact, all in this together, that some of us may be affected more or less. You know, like if you have a big apartment building and there are some people who are on the side of a building where the roof is leaking and they get more flooding or they get more damage. And then you're in another part of the building that doesn't have that. And so you don't have to think about what people who are dealing with the leaky roof in the other side of the building have to think about. Yes, you may say, oh, that's unfortunate, but you don't have to live with it. And you might not do anything about it because you don't have to deal with it. The problem is when we deny that other people are experiencing these challenges due to what we have inherited. That is where the problem comes in. I mean, the problem comes if we do not know what is going on in our house, our collective house. There comes a time when if people are not taught, and a lot of the history, I mean, when The Warmth of the Suns first came out, a lot of people came up to me afterward and they said, I had no idea. These are people who lived through the era that I'm writing about. And they said, I had no idea, was not being taught in the schools. The Great Migration didn't get taught in the schools. And so on some level, if people don't know their history, it means that, you know, you cannot expect complete awareness if people have not been taught. But once you know, that's when the responsibility comes in. I mean, once you know that something is wrong, then there comes the responsibility to do something about it. I mean, I actually pictured myself in working on this book as like the building inspector, the inspector of a building, and the building happens to be, you know, a country. And I'm presenting essentially this report. It's really a prayer for people to hear and to listen, open their hearts to take in this report, an x-ray of our country. And then once you know, then the responsibilities come, especially for those who have not had to deal with the roof leaking in their particular apartment. For people who've not had to deal with the downsides and deprivations that come from being assigned to a subordinated, subjugated caste historically with shadows to the current day, the responsibility then does fall on all of us because we all have to live with the consequences. And we may be hurt even though we may not realize it, but everyone is hurt by this. And that's where the responsibility comes in.
So you choose to examine caste in this country in comparison, and not so much contrast, mostly in comparison, to so-called caste systems in India and also in Nazi Germany. I'll get to the German example in a second. But going back to the Indian example, you tell a story about how Martin Luther King Jr. traveled once for a month to India, in part because his approach of nonviolence was one that was embraced by Mahatma Gandhi and others to gain independence from India. And you tell a story about how Martin Luther King is talking to folks about the caste system. And as people may know, and they will come to know more if they read your book, the lowest caste in India is the so-called untouchable, the Dalit. And their lot in life is very, very poor. And there's very little they can do to get out of that lot in life. And many of them are relegated to doing the worst jobs that other people don't want to do, cleaning, etc. Explain the revelation that King had when he was having a conversation in India.
Well, he was very excited to go because he so admired the nonviolent protests of Mahatma Gandhi. Of Mohandas Gandhi, and he was received by the prime minister with a very beautiful arrival there. And then he made a trip to visit a Dalit school, what would have been called an untouchable school, a school where the students and everyone there, the people working there, were part of the what was then known as the untouchable caste. And so upon arrival, and the principal that introduces him to the children, and he says, you know, children, let me, young people, I want to introduce you to a fellow untouchable from America. The head of the school made the connection between the African-American experience that he was seeing on the news from the civil rights era, civil rights movement, made the immediate connection and introduced Dr. King as an untouchable from America. And upon hearing that, Dr. King had not made that connection initially, and he actually was a little peeved to have been described that way. He didn't see himself as that. He viewed himself as, in the word would have been, an American Negro at that time. He was very celebrated. So he'd had dinner with the prime minister. He did not see himself as an untouchable. And then he thought about it, and he remembered that, you know, he was at that very stage in his life advocating on behalf of people who were, even at that moment, the vast majority of them denied the right to vote. The civil rights legislation would not come until several years after that. They were held, as you described, to the lowest positions, particularly when they were in the American South. But even when they went to the North, they were assigned to the dirtiest, most dangerous jobs in the foundries and the steel mills and the factories. They were sharecroppers. They literally were assigned to the lowest rung in American society. And he was fighting on their behalf. And he thought to himself, yes, I am an American untouchable. And every Black person in America is an untouchable. He made that recognition. I mean, another example of someone who was so very lauded and honored. He made the connection, too, after being exposed to and seeing how he was viewed by untouchables there. He recognized it as well. And he actually gave a sermon on the 4th of July in 1965 at his church, Ebenezer Baptist Church, in which he relayed that story, which is one of the reasons that we know about it. He relayed that story about how he came to the recognition that the United States had a caste system and that people like him had been assigned to the bottom of it.
Stay tuned for more discussion. We'll be right back after a short break.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Beloved brands know customer relationships are everything. That's why over 130,000 trust Klaviyo to power smarter digital relationships across their websites, emails, SMS, and reviews. And now, there's Klaviyo AI, your guide to smarter insights, decisions, work, and results. Brands like Everyman Jack trust Klaviyo AI to personalize product recommendations that keep customers coming back. Discover Klaviyo AI at klaviyo.com/box. That's klaviyo.com/box.
Let's move to Germany. And I imagine that some people will not love the idea of comparing what you call the American caste system to what Nazi Germany was like, in part because some people, I imagine, would say, well, whatever you say about the caste system in India or the United States and how much exploitation there was and how much death there was and how much lynching there was not an ideology of the final solution of utter elimination, which there was ultimately in Nazi Germany. But that said, you tell another story. I'm going to be quoting from the book again. You tell another story, but at least sort of early in the Nazi regime that I had not heard before, and it brings a lot of things home. In June of 1934, various academics and officials in Nazi Germany were trying to get together because they still cared a little bit about reputation and trying to figure out how they might pass these blood laws and what the language should be to prevent intermarriage. And they needed a prototype. And they sat around and they thought to themselves, well, in America, we have a pretty good example. We have a pretty good precedent. And the more they thought about it, some of them you recite in the book said, you know, we can't even believe that that's really enforced in the United States. But the passage that struck me the most was the following, quote, "Mindful of appearances beyond their borders, for the time being at least, the Nazis wondered how the United States had managed to turn its racial hierarchy into rigid law, yet retain such a sterling reputation on the world stage," end quote. How did they manage to do that?
How did the United States manage to do that?
Yeah.
Well, I have to preface this by saying that what propelled me to Germany was Charlottesville, which is the way to even get to the answer of what you just asked. And that is that, you know, after Charlottesville, that contention over the statues and the Confederate and Nazi symbolism that fused together among the ralliers themselves, and that battle over memory of the Civil War and of slavery and how do we define heroes in America. So that the connection was made by the people who were protesting in Charlottesville. They made the connection with the symbolisms of flags and the swastikas, of Confederate flags and swastikas that they themselves carried, and in fact replicated some of the marches that would have occurred in Germany during that time. So the focus for me was not initially the Nazis themselves, but actually how Germany had worked in the decades after the war, after World War II, to reconcile its history and to atone for it. So what had they done? And that's what brought me to Germany in the first place. And, you know, the deeper I looked into it, then I came across or discovered, made these connections. I discovered these connections that I would never have imagined myself. I had no idea that German eugenicists were in continuing dialogue with American eugenicists, that American eugenicists wrote these books that were big sellers in Germany in the years leading up to the Third Reich. And it was gut-wrenching to see these connections. And then, of course, having to remind ourselves at all times that the Nazis needed no one to teach them how to hate, absolutely no one. And, of course, they carried it further than anyone would ever have imagined. It's incomprehensible what they ultimately did. Well, what they did before that moment was they actually sent researchers to study America's Jim Crow laws and to see how Americans had subjugated and segregated African Americans. And they, as you did the meeting that you talk about in June of 1934, they were debating and consulting American law as they were devising what would ultimately become the Nuremberg Laws. And as you said, it was shocking to see that some of them didn't even believe that the United States would have gone to the lengths that they were discovering that it had. I think that they were interested in finding a way to justify what they were doing. And they turned to the United States in order to do that. And also to see what were the possibilities about how they could do it with what we call anti-miscegenation laws against intermarriage between people of different quote unquote races, which would be equivalent to its endogamy in the Indian context of the language is often endogamy. And here it's anti-miscegenation laws. In Germany, they were seeking to find ways to maintain whatever reputation they perceive themselves to have had in that early going and to look for ways that other places had done it. And the place that they turned to, they looked other places, but the place that they turned to finally was the United States.
Do you think it's in human DNA or social DNA for groups to want to be superior to at least one other group? Is that just an inevitability that we have to deal with, a pathogen, as you might say, or can we outgrow that?
I would like to believe that, you know, there may have been a time when there was long, 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 long ago when humans did not have access to the technologies and advancements that we now take for granted, where people were out in the frontier, out in the wilderness, out on the land, and were in danger perhaps almost every minute of their lives, that people needed to band together in order to protect themselves. But we have advanced as a species, and we are now at a point where we have at our instant access information that others before us could not have imagined. I would like to believe that because of the advancements and because of the, in some ways, the luxury of being able to sit and to contemplate and to read and to, you know, we might have a question that comes in our mind and we can instantly find the answer, you know, on our devices. I mean, we have the luxury of being able to see things differently and not to be fighting each other, because there are much greater challenges that we face as a species, that the planet faces, that, you know, we should be in a position of coming together somehow to recognize the greater threats to human happiness, human health, human wealth. The fact that we still have these health challenges that can do such damage to human beings. Why do we not have a cure for cancer? Why do we not have a solution to challenges of polluted waters that people are having to deal with, for example, in Flint, Michigan, even to this day? I mean, why are these things, you know, we should be so advanced as a species that some of the things that make life so much more challenging for people, it seems to me that there should be a way to push back, you know, to find ways to transcend them. And I would say that one of the greatest tragedies of any caste system, any hierarchy, such as those that I'm describing, is the lost potential and lost lives, of course, of people who did not have the opportunity to live out their life's potential, whatever talents and gifts they might have had for over generations. I mean, speaking of the United States, which is the focus of this book, you know, for 246 years, 12 generations of people, African Americans, who were not permitted to live out whatever expertise, ever talent they might have had. I mean, if you think about those cotton fields and rice plantations and sugar plantations and all those different plantations, there were opera singers and jazz musicians and lawyers.
You have a chapter about Satchel Paige, the pitcher, who, you know, people know. And he had a little bit of a career in the major leagues, but most of it was denied him. You have a lot of real examples like that. This concept of not wanting to be the bottom rung, I think you even have a chapter or a section entitled The Necessity of the Bottom Rung. It helps certain people perpetuate their power. And an observation you make, I think, is an important one as people think about the last election and as they think about power and voting in America now. And it has to do with this observation that some liberals have, which is, why would some people in America, working white class or poor white citizens, voters, why would they vote against their interest? And you say this in your book, quote, "Why some people on the left keep asking, why, oh, why were these people voting against their own interests? The questioners on the left were unseeing and yet so certain. What they had not considered was that the people voting this way were, in fact, voting their interests. Maintaining the caste system as it had always been was in their interest, and some were willing to accept short-term discomfort, forego health insurance, risk contamination of the water and air, and even die to protect their long-term interest in the hierarchy as they had known it." What is that long-term interest in a system that is not doing much for them?
Well, that's assuming that the system is not doing much for them by the standards or the even unspoken and even maybe unrecognized, when you think of unconscious bias, the unconscious messaging that everyone in a caste system receives, that the less one has to fall back on in a competitive, really forbidding economy that has very little in the way of a safety net compared to other Western nations, the less you have to fall back on in the way of education, wealth, job security, the more one may rely on inherited status that's accorded to people in the dominant caste over the, you know, the history of this country. And that means that there'd be a greater investment. The greater the investment, the less one has to fall back on, the greater the investment there would be in maintaining the hierarchy as it has been known, because that has been the means by which, you know, as I was saying before, you know, the idea of standing and respect and benefit of the doubt that and access to resources that are deeply known by people up and down the hierarchy. There was a professor in Andrew Hacker, professor who used to ask his students, his white students, how much would you have to be paid? How much would you expect to be paid if you knew that you would have to spend the next 50 years of your life as a Black person in America? How much would you want to be paid? What would you think would be a fair compensation for for being transferred into a different caste, you might say? And the students would get together and they, you know, figured out, in one of his classes, they got together and figured out a number. And the number that they came back with was $50 million, $1 million for every year that they would have to be Black, that they would have to be African American. And so people know, they know the value that's inherited and not of anyone's doing. No one asked to be at any station in the caste system. I mean, you are born where you're born, and you have nothing to do with it. So this is not about blaming in any way, shape, or form. This is about recognition that once you see the almost unspoken hierarchy that positions some people above other people, people know that there's a value to that. And I think the students in that professor's class, you know, get at what I'm talking about here.
There's this other phenomenon that goes on when people talk about racism and inequality in the country. And that is this: someone who has achieved something, who happens to be Black, either as an actor or an entertainer or an athlete, and says, well, the system's unfair. And then some folks will say, well, I don't know what you're complaining about from your mansion and with your collection of Rolls Royces, et cetera. And you tell some stories about how, you know, fame and success don't protect you always. There's a, not from as erudite a source as you tend to cite in your book, but the comedian Chris Rock, I think, talked about this in connection with police brutality. He's like, yeah, I'm famous, but not at a distance.
Right. Yeah.
respond to the folks, because again, this is another thing that I think should be very readily understandable, but people keep making this point. Respond to the folks who say Oprah Winfrey or LeBron James or whoever else have no business or right to complain about how Black people are treated in this country.
So I describe caste as the bones, race as the skin, and class as the clothing, diction, accent, education, the things that one can change about oneself. And in any society, there are going to be exceptions to any rule. And there are some incredibly exceptional people who were born into the subordinated caste or the historically subordinated caste in America and in India as well, who have managed, despite all of the odds, to persevere with fortitude, talent, all that it took in order to transcend the barriers and to rise to very high in their society. There are a lot of things I could say about that, one of them having to do with occupational, how caste represents itself in occupations. I mean, in occupations, the opening for African Americans has tended to be in sports, in music and entertainment, because during the originating decades formation of this hierarchy in the caste system, which was actually a legal caste system, there were actually laws that indicated there were attempts to say what Black people could do legally, and then it extended to the culture, so that there are certain fields that have been more open to African Americans over time, and one of them having to be entertainment. The enslaved people were often used for entertainment. They were, there's a famous scene out of 12 Years a Slave in which they were roused from their sleep in order to entertain at 2 in the morning or whatever, to entertain the owner. They were, you know, tired from having, you know, worked, you know, 15-hour days tending to the sugarcane, and then they had to go perform. And so that actually is a very old through line in how a, you know, roles that people play percolate through a society. So that's one thing. One thing is that that has been an area of opening for people that has meaning even in the current day. The majority of the wealthiest of African Americans tend to come from those fields, people where they were among the most talented maybe of humans of Americans in whoever did whatever they're doing. And then they often became moguls in that field. That's where a lot of the billionaires, the wealthiest African Americans tend to come from. But the interesting thing is that there's several things to say. One is that despite these people that we can identify as among the most recognizable and wealthiest people in the United States, the situation for the majority of African Americans is so disparate compared to their white counterparts, that despite these people whose names come to mind, we know these are among the wealthiest people among us, even factoring them in to the collective wealth of African Americans, with them factored in, African Americans still have only 1/10 of what their white counterparts have in the way of wealth. And this is over the course of generations of being legally excluded from the opportunities to build wealth, to live the American dream. Something so basic as getting a mortgage was not available to African Americans, at least a government-backed mortgage. Government-backed mortgages were not available to African Americans because the redlining meant that the places that were forbidden to the government would not back the mortgages were neighborhoods where Black people lived. So Black people were not able to, you know, make the most of or even make use of the most common form of wealth building in America. It is literally the American dream. They were denied by law from the American dream until the 1960s. So the idea of African Americans as a whole being able to make to actually enter the mainstream is very, very new. So in spite of the fact that we have these incredibly wealthy people in that group, the group as a whole is still laboring under the deficits and the deprivations, legally sanctioned deprivations of all the generations that preceded them. And then one other thing I want to say about this is that when I say that class, you know, is the clothes and the diction and the accents and the things we can control, the fact of the matter is if you can, in the way that I look at it, if you can act your way out of it, it's class. If you cannot act your way out of it, it's caste. And so the high-ranking people, the recognizable people, many of them have examples. I mean, I include some in the book myself, of you're going about your day, and I don't put myself in the category of these people, but I'm saying any person who is a professional who's moving about in the world, an African-American, could be in an instant reminded of their caste category. There's an example out of the UK that's an interesting one, that's just a recent one, where the editor of British Vogue, and a man of African descent, he was entering his building. He's the editor of British Vogue, and he's told by the security guard to use the loading dock, the loading freight elevator in his own office building. And that means here's someone who would have been dressed maybe better than almost any human, really, if you imagine the editor of Vogue would be very well dressed.
Carrying, I would imagine, yes.
And then told to use the loading elevator, freight elevator in his own building. And so if you cannot act your way out of that kind of intrusion of caste, caste being, you know, the example of where, who belongs where, who is expected to be doing what, you know, what are the boundaries and barriers, boundaries and assumptions about who should be doing what. He was not expected to be of someone of that stature. And it was the recognition of that on the basis of his, of what he looked like, meaning the things that, the very things that you cannot change about yourself. He could change his clothes. He could change his accent. He could change his diction. He could do all of that. But he could not change the signifier of where someone fits in the caste system.
So let's end with talking about what we do about all this. You're the building inspector. What are your prescriptions for how we fix this old house that is America? And one of the things I'd like to hear you elaborate on is a concept you mentioned in the book of radical empathy. Where do we go from here?
I have to say that if you bought a house and the building inspector comes in and delivers their report, the building inspector does not tell you what you need to do. The building inspector presents to you the problems that need to be addressed. And that is how I see myself. If I had wanted to take another 5 years on this, I would have done the additional research in order to be able to come up with, you know, a 10-point plan about what this would be. But I would say that we're talking about something that is 400 years old. You know, we're talking about an embedded hierarchy that we've inherited that, you know, gets affirmed in all in billboards and television commercials and, you know, who gets killed first in a movie. I mean, we know, and we have been exposed to this for so long that, you know, that even a third of African Americans hold unconscious bias against themselves. So this is long and this is deep. And I would never presume to say these are all the answers, because the answers have to come from all of us. It cannot come from one person. It will not come from someone who is, you know, born to what would be viewed as the subordinated caste. There's not it, there. It, this falls on everyone to, first of all, do the work to know our country's comprehensive history, and then to search ourselves and find the ways that we as individuals can do something in our own lives, looking very hard and deep. And then for others who are in positions of making policy, and I'm a writer, not a policymaker, to also do the work of knowing our country's history and looking clear-eyed at the x-ray of our country to come up with solutions to our collective problem, because we are all in this building together. And it's not generally the building inspector doesn't make the repairs anyway. It's the owner, and we are all the owners of this building.
We certainly are. In the epilogue of your book, you talk about Albert Einstein, who was a great ally in many ways to the so-called lower caste. And you write, quote, you know, you talk about how we have all these problems, but then, quote, and yet somehow there are the rare people like Einstein who seem immune to the toxins of caste in the air we breathe, who manage to transcend what most people are susceptible to, end quote. Do you have an observation as to what the qualities are in people that might make them immune to the toxins of caste?
I haven't given a tremendous amount of thought because I've just finished the book, but being asked this by you, and I'd like to explore this more and think this through more, because I think that that is something that this work does allow us all a window into. But I would say that, first of all, what I see consistent among the people who I would identify as being like Einstein would be people who have an essential comfort within themselves about who they are and what their own talents and abilities may be. In other words, how self-actualized are you to begin with? How comfortable are you with yourself? If you have insecurities, if you feel easily threatened, if you feel that others are gaining on you, doing things that they don't deserve because you should be here and you're not where you wish to be, that would be one of the things I would say would make it harder for you to have the the generosity of spirit toward others and might would make you more likely to be invested in keeping things the way that they are for whatever benefit may be coming to you, whether you even have a name for it or not. So one of them would be a sense of self-actualization and an awareness of oneself and a sense of contentment within oneself, that you don't have to prove anything to anyone else. You see the world as you feel that you have been, that things are going well for you personally, and you do not need to see anyone beneath you in order to feel good about yourself. I mean, here's someone who was one of the smartest men who ever lived, and he was being told that people who looked a certain way, people who were African-American, were beneath him. And he, as the smartest person, one of the smartest people who ever lived, looked at them and said, no, I see them as like me. I see the things I have in common with them. And that means that he was very confident in himself, clearly. And intelligence alone does not mean that you're confident. He just was. I think that he had a sense of empathy, a sense of connection with others. He had himself escaped Nazi Germany just before the Nazis actually came into power. He barely escaped, but he could see the injustices that were brewing. He could see the ethnic tribalism and hatreds that were brewing. He could see that, and he could see the dangers of that, and he recognized how wrong that was. He recognized the dangers, I should say, of that kind of thinking, and could see even then how that could lead to something. And then I would say an essential sense of recognition of our common humanity. I mean, a recognition that we do have things in common, and that you can learn and grow from knowing other people, seeing other people for who they really are, and a lack of a need to be better than someone else. I mean, a willingness to see that all of us have something to offer. Even the short conversations that we might have when we're on a shuttle bus to get from point A to point B, and you can have a lovely conversation with someone on a train. And you never know where that beauty in life might be, the beauty in humanity, seeing the beauty in humanity and feeling that you are rooting not for your team, but for the species as a whole, that we all win, a belief that there is something that we all gain when everyone is at their very best.
I think that's a good note to end on. Isabel Wilkerson, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on this very important book. It really is a must-read. I really think it is. And if anyone needs any further encouragement to read the book, just pick up the New York Times review. It'll knock your socks off.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Stay Tuned. Thanks again to my guest, Isabel Wilkerson.
If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet, or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to letters@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by CAFE and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. The CAFE team is David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Sean Walsh, Namita Shah, and Claudia Hernandez. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.